Campus FM presents The Probe, produced and presented by Monique Chambers. Welcome to The Probe with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Dr. Maria Broguglio from the Department of Economics, FERMA, here at the University of Malta. Her subject is market failure, which sounds really interesting. Tell us about market failure.
Okay, so when we study economics, we generally study how markets work, the beauty of the competitive system, which results in the lowest possible prices and people basically consuming what gives them satisfaction. We talk about the necessity to let the markets work as freely as possible, okay, with as little, let's say, interference as possible. We then talk about how these markets altogether create gross domestic product, mm-hmm, which is the size of the economy. And we're generally, as economists, pretty happy to let the invisible hand of the market do the work. However, we also know as economists, and some of us specialize in this field, that sometimes things go a little bit wrong with the markets. So one of the things that we know goes wrong is that some people can't actually play the game because they don't have enough income. So it's a little, mm-hmm, bit like being on a monopoly board and your money runs out and you basically can't play, except we're not dealing with a game, but we're dealing with real life. So that's one of the problems that we like to study. We talk about income distribution and so on. We also worry about market failure when some entity becomes too large and it has monopoly power, mm-hmm, and so therefore we don't actually have these low prices that we so much revere. But my area is when the market fails to reflect how scarce a particular resource is, and that results in wastage. I deal with environmental pollution, which results from the operation of markets. I study the resources which we extract and for which we don't pay the price, okay, and the pollution we emit into our systems, whether it's into the air or land or sea, which we don't pay for. And because markets are so dependent on price to give a signal of scarcity, when we don't pay for something, we overdo it. And that's basically what I spend most of my time looking into, what kind of stuff we're overdoing because we're not paying the price for.
And does that have a terminology? What's the name?
So we call the field environmental economics. Mm-hmm. We call the phenomenon market failure.
Okay.
We call the absence of a price an externality because it's a price that is external to whoever is creating it.
Right.
Normally, when you want something, you pay the price, mm-hmm, you put your hand in your own pocket, and you pay for it. But when you create pollution, somebody else is paying for, mm-hmm, that pollution, so it's external to you. And so we call that an externality. Okay. We have lots of fancy words like these, but when you come down to it, a lot of them are pretty intuitive.
Okay, so why is this becoming a study now?
Oh, so environmental economics really took off, I would say, in the 60s, but increasingly has become a field of study in economics, which is really large and growing. There's conferences and journals and all sorts of things, okay, that you can imagine by which to calibrate how large a field of study is. It ticks all the boxes. It's now a course in any undergraduate course in economics, and it's a unit in any undergraduate course. So I would say that it's been growing and it's pretty much there. Of course, as pollution increases, it becomes an issue of greater interest. And as environmental resources become more scarce, as we start to run out of space and we start to run out of, in Malta's case, for example, limestone, mm-hmm, groundwater, biodiversity, the more this resource becomes scarce, the more it becomes of interest to economists. And the reason is that economics is actually the study of scarcity.
Okay. So is this something, a phenomenon that's getting more popular because of, you know, the millennials, they're more eco-friendly than, you know, people my age, and they sort of do want to protect their,
okay,
planet?
So when it comes to people's preferences and what people do in their consumer behavior, we do observe that there are differences in generations, and we do observe that there are differences in how people respond to different forms of intervention. What you're talking about almost relies on voluntary mechanisms. Okay. So some people are actually interested in doing this of their own free will, in reversing their impacts, and they get something which we call, as economists, warm glow.
Okay.
Okay, so we don't think that you're purely altruistic. Mm-hmm. We think that yours is an impure kind of altruism, because you get something back. Mm-hmm. You get a warm glow for doing it. And that, in economics, is finding increasing ground, actually, as you rightly say, because we find that, actually, if you tax people or incentivize them monetarily or by legislation, they lose this warm glow. So sometimes you just have to let people do it, or encourage them to do it of their own free will. It's a little bit like donating blood. You get a warm glow for donating blood. Some people may have suggested, and have suggested in the past, giving money for blood. And you would get some people who go to give blood for the money, but you would lose, or you might lose, those people who would give blood for the warm glow of doing something right.
But you see, I'm one of those people. I get a warm glow when I buy a new pair of shoes. So it's different satisfaction level.
Absolutely. And most of economics deals with people like you.
Okay.
So this notion of relying on voluntary warm glow and pure altruism is actually quite new. But mostly in economics, we assume that people get a warm glow from consumption, from buying stuff. And that's why a lot of economics has focused on taxing people to get them to do the right thing.
Right.
Or using somehow the incentives which we know work, because people are economic creatures.
So how is industry tackling the problem then for, you know, people like me who do like to buy stuff? Okay, I do like to buy vintage stuff as well occasionally, getting more and more popular in Malta, thankfully. But how are they addressing, you know, some countries are banning coffee capsules and disposable cups. How are you addressing this?
Okay, so I think there's actually two questions there. The first is, what's industry doing about it? And the other is sort of, should we maybe as government or as, you know, regulatory authorities be doing something which even regulates industry? So some industries have actually found a market opportunity in these new tastes, these new sort of ecological awareness. So, of course, you've got companies that offer fair trade goods.
What is fair trade? Sorry, just to, because so you see it often stamped on something.
Basically, we're talking about a production process which doesn't waste resources, but neither does it waste people. It doesn't have these harmful, it doesn't use children, it fairly compensates people, this kind of approach. So when we're saying, what do companies do about it? First of all, our assumption as economists is that most businesses are in it for profit. And actually, to be a free marketeer about it, you wouldn't be a good business if you weren't looking at the bottom line. But some businesses actually profit from looking at a bottom line, which also includes environmental consciousness, because they can attract good employees that way, because they have better insurance ratings that way, because they attract a certain client that way, or because they are looking at the future and they're thinking of the sustainability. Okay. In some entities, you also have an entrepreneur who actually gets a warm glow for doing it this way. But generally, I think that what are we doing about it is a question that is asked of governments and not of industry, and neither of consumers individually. Okay. So it's something that requires regulation. So, you know, the sort of classic answer to market failure is government intervention. If the market fails, someone has to regulate it. The market is composed of consumers and producers, and the regulator is government. So that's the very simple diagram of how we explain life in economic terms. Consumers are there to get their satisfaction. The producers are there to get their profit. Somehow this results in market failure, where we get all these environmental mm-hmm. problems, and we need to fix the system.
Okay.
And we cannot rely completely on voluntary fixing of the system, because, hey, look where voluntary has got us.
Yes, it's a slow start,
exactly.
All good intentions. So companies may be employing people to do corporate social responsibility. What are governments doing, or what are you doing to help governments?
Okay, so this is really getting close now to where we're getting to sort of the heart of fixing the problem. So first of all, there's governance at different levels. We've got local councils trying to do something about it at the very local level, like litter.
Mm-hmm.
We've got, and sort of fixing the problem once it's done, most of the cases.
Yeah.
We've got national government, so we've got authorities like the Environment Resource Authority, we've got the Resources Authority, we've got even the Economic Ministry trying to tax some behaviors and some, you know, goods and services. And then you've got the supranational. And here, the European Union is very important. There's about 200 pieces of legislation, which Malta had to bring in as its own, report to the European Commission what it's doing about it.
Okay.
So there's plenty of regulation.
How do we score in those things as a country?
So, you know, we score in different ways on different aspects. So, for example, if you were to break down the environment in different components, mostly, for example, for seawater quality, things are good.
Okay.
There are the instances like we saw this summer, but generally we're kind of blessed by our location too. When it comes to groundwater quality, we've got some problems with pollution from pesticides and nitrates and over-extraction, so we really need to step it up there to bring our water quality to what it should be. When it comes to air quality, we've got, you know, some areas where we exceed what we should be observing,
okay.
And then we need to make plans to reduce pollution. So the European Union monitors this very regularly. I mean, we've got daily exceedances and we send reports about this, so... And really, I could go into every area, but you don't need to be an expert to know how we score on the environmental issues, because you walk in Emcida, you walk in Hamroun, or you walk in Pieta or Slema,
mm-hmm.
and you can see what the air quality is.
Yes.
You can feel what the air quality is. And in fact, the Maltese people are the most, according to one recent study, among Europeans, we're the most concerned with air quality.
Okay.
We're also the noisiest.
That doesn't surprise me.
We have quite a few records, actually, in the environment. But, you know, you have to also understand that we are the most densely populated country, the smallest, so the pressures environmentally are tremendous.
And we do like to have new things. We are also a nation of shopaholics. The shops
we
are
shop,
never empty.
We eat a lot, too, which doesn't really create pollution we'd like to talk about here in this program, but it is also, you know, we do consume.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the greatest consumers in Europe. Actually, we're among the ones that consume least per capita, you know. Yes, but we also are pretty good at recycling now, even though that was all voluntary.
So the recycling that's collected from our doorstep,
mm-hmm.
or
yep.
Are there any sort of restaurants and things like that taking any charge?
No, that will be the next wave where it needs to be tackled. I must say that there is perhaps a misconception that the Maltese won't cooperate when it comes to environmental issues. But in fact, the recycling scheme, which was purely voluntarily, actually we even, in a sense, penalized households for doing it because they had to buy the grey bags, whereas not recycling came completely free and
yes.
daily.
Yes.
And people still did it, and they did it in large numbers. So I think there is hope to, you know, if the system, if the infrastructure is there that gets people moving in the right direction, people will move in the right direction. But then again, it's back to governance. We need to get these legislation, which we have from the European Union, and implement as many of them as possible.
So how do we do that? Because there's going to be a communications issue. Like you say, the recycling went down well. How do you communicate across the country to not just the locals, but also the tourists, the things you're trying to do to...
So it's a,
and
it's
industry, of course. Industry has got to be a huge...
So very often what happens in these issues is you have a goal set in agreement with other countries, but you then present an implementation plan. Okay. And in this implementation plan, you target, as you rightly said, the different segments of the population. And some might be lower-lying fruit than others. So when it comes to air quality, for example, it's much easier to target the one power station than it is to target the hundreds and thousands of car owners.
Yes,
so sometimes, you know, as the institution responsible for air quality, you start with the highest risk, basically. And then you cascade down. And as, you know, time goes by, you start to pick the higher fruit and until you get to the level where you want to get to. But, you know, that's what government does. And that's what the institutions that government sets up are supposed to do. Has it moved fast enough? Not in more than probably not anywhere in the world. Of course, there are countries that do much better, that are the kind of torchbearers for us, that even push the European Union to go faster.
Is that like Germany, who always have this, you know, it's almost a stereotypical that they recycle everything, they're very green?
Yes, it's countries like Germany, Sweden, Denmark, you know, I mean, and in a sense, in every field, there's some star country, you know. But in fact, Germany is the lead partner in one of the projects that I'm working on, where we are actively trying to improve operations in business, trying to see what governments can do better to get businesses to improve their operations. And we're doing this with 14 other countries so that whatever advice we give is informed not just by the realities of the key negotiators, but also by the realities of smaller countries and so forth.
And also, I was just thinking, as you spoke there about Sweden, Denmark and Germany being sort of leaders in the field, we have such a mixed community now with the iGaming. You'd imagine they expect us to be a little more responsible with our planet.
Yeah, you know, this is a very interesting question. So how do people behave when they're out of their country? That's, you know, do they carry the norms of their country to this other country, or do they adapt to the other country? And also one argument which the European Commission sometimes brings is, look, we need a basic environmental quality throughout the European Union, because we don't think that one particular nation deserves to have better quality environment than the other. Not to mention that, as you say, people move. So, you know, a basic level, normally informed by the World Health Organization, that basic standard normally, you know, needs to be respected, because otherwise we're talking about impacts on health, not just on recreation or quality of life, but we're directly hitting risk. So, yeah, so you'd expect that, you know, the more diverse our population gets, the more pressure there would be for environmental standards to improve. But recall that our population is getting diverse in many different ways, and many different nationals are taking up residence in our country. And that in itself is an interesting question of how to regulate when you don't any longer have a homogeneous society. Even down simply to what type of language are you going to use when you issue your communications?
Okay. I would have thought they, you know, they would have come and almost demanded and like, well, where do we do our recycling? Where do we
That happens.
Fill our bottles? Where do we...
That happens, but it also happens by Maltese people. You know, I mean, there is, in my research, I have found quite a demand for environmental regulation by households. People are thirsty for increased intervention.
Okay. So what's this project you're working on, and how is that going to help, you know, the regular Joe to be more eco-friendly? And, you know, because of the actions that you'll essentially force the government to take.
So basically what we're trying to do with this project is we're targeting what we think is a little bit of a vacuum, which is... We've got this notion of how an economy can be less impactful.
Okay.
That is, less extractive and polluting, but instead keeps the resources inside the system without wasting them. We know that that's where we want to get to. We also know that business can have a great influence on this in the way it produces stuff, in what it produces, in what it markets. But what we're not quite sure is how to translate this goal into something that businesses actually do. We've had solutions like regulation, like taxes, like punishment, like enforcement. But we think we might be missing something. We might be missing, for example, the fact that businesses are actually run by humans and that a more behavioral approach might work to get these things. A lot of businesses are actually small businesses, which means that there could be a possibility to tackle the human motivation. We've also may have missed the point that some regulation is really complex. So how are we going to simplify to get action on the ground? And this is the kind of question we're asking. How do we go from a circular economic model to a circular business model where business people know, understand, are motivated to do stuff that reduces the impact?
So are you talking to the consumer to go back to the business, or are you encouraging the business to talk to their consumer? Because they might not even think about, you know, in Italy it's very common to have your washing liquids. You take your bottle, you even go and get that from the supermarket, you fill up your bottle. I have seen it in Malta, but only in one place. Is that the sort of thing that you're,
yes,
you're creating?
So one of the things we want to capture is where it's actually happening. Why does it happen? What drives this when it actually, so first of all, so we don't lose it, but secondly, also to see the mechanisms that have made this possible. But yes, to answer your question, we are talking to the consumers because we know that businesses care about the consumers. So may businesses have missed this potential? Perhaps because consumers don't get to express their environmental preferences because the market hides these issues. Perhaps businesses have missed this opportunity. We don't know, but we will explore whatever it takes to get business to repair the market failure.
You're just saying repair there. I'm just going to use the word in a different context. Because my grandparents were great ones for, you know, fix it, fix it, fix it. My generation a bit more, get a new one, you know, just chuck it out. And then obviously our kids are more fix it, fix it, fix it, buy it retro. Malta has a problem, not as bad as it used to be, with dumping of products. People just don't even take them to the tips that are available, open 7 days a week, whatever. How can we address that glut of product then that ends up on the road rather than someone actually taking it to a...
So this is, you know, a beautiful question. First of all, I'm going to tell you that according to quite a few studies actually done by the Eurobarometer, the Maltese are really annoyed at dumping. So let's not think that it is, you know, the general trend that the Maltese people dump. There's a few people. But when you ask the Maltese people, should there be heavy fines for this? They will say yes. Much more than Europeans do. Of course, that could be due to the fact that there's much more dumping taking place. But still, there is a preference being revealed there by, you know, a good sample of the Maltese population who are not filling in the survey in a written format, but on the phone. That means you've captured everybody. Who are telling you, we want heavier fines for this type of behavior. So that's the first part, that there, you know, you're right to mention it as an issue, but I wanted to make it a point to tell you that it's annoying for a lot of Maltese people that this takes place. The other thing that you sort of point out is that there might be some kind of preference which changes for repair. So, you know, can we actually motivate or stimulate this taste for repair? And we know that, you know, products go through fashion, are very capable of being influenced. You know, we may wear a thick heel 1 year or a thin heel the other, or no heel in the next year. First we want our mobile phone to be super small, and now we need it to be super large. So it's quite possible to influence taste. And the desire for repair is one of those things. Now, apart from the fact that you can actually encourage business to market repair as a feature,
okay,
if they see that there is this latent demand for repairability, it's also possible to be more draconian about it and to make it mandatory, or to make it, let's say, incentivized for businesses to produce stuff that isn't made for the dump. That is, to build repairability into their stuff. How do you do that? Well, for example, if you take a mobile phone or a laptop, you make it modular so that you can actually replace a part of it when that part goes wrong. And actually, the European Union is working towards this. So if you talk about repair, yes, you're talking about tastes of the consumer and influencing those tastes, but there's also a production element to it. So you can want repair till you're blue in the face, but if you cannot repair your iPad or your phone or your tablet or whatever it is, you know, then you just don't consider that as part of your options. In a sense, the consumer has a lot of power, but the choice has to be there for the consumer to make. Otherwise, the consumer is left with no choice except to either not buy the thing at all, which in the case of technology is unlikely to happen, or simply dump it when it breaks down.
Yes, out of the window in the middle of the countryside. But there are fines in place, isn't there? A WEEE directive or something? You can't throw batteries away, you can't throw electronics away. So there are.
So there's plenty of regulation, and regulations normally come with fines. That's sort of what we call the command and control approach. And, you know, for the most, I would say that the systems are in place so that things can be done well. And what this project is doing is really trying to see where policy has failed and can be improved too. Because to come back to your first question about market failure, we also talk about government failure. And so that's where, in a sense, this project is not only looking at the market failure, which we take as given now, we know that happens, but we're also looking at whether policy has failed and can do better.
So where can we find out a bit more about this project of yours?
Well, you can go on the university website. The project is called R2PI, which is Route to Circular.
Okay.
And there'll be more information. We've just signed contracts. We've just, you know, put a consortium place, all of that stuff, so that we can finally meet and kick off the project this December.
Well, I'm really looking forward to being part of this. So thank you very much. That's Dr. Maria Bruguglio from the Department of Economics here at the University of Malta. It's a fascinating talk on the circular economy.
You have just listened to The Probe, produced and presented by Monique Chambers.